From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a group of Americans talk about their experiences meeting recent U.S. deportees in El Salvador.
Later, a local anti-hunger activist authors a children's book, but hopes that her effort goes far beyond that.
I would say that this isn't just a book. This is a movement that we're causing that's being translated and retold through storytelling.
And Milwaukee guitarist Greg Koch didn't plan to create his latest band, the Koch Marshall Trio, but then he met organist Toby Lee Marshall when they set up the recording studio.
So I call a shuffle tonight. Let's just do like a shuffle in G. And I counted it off, and we recorded it. And that's actually going to be the first tune on the record. The very first notes we ever played together. It was so instantaneous. I went, oh my God.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's been more than two decades since the Salvadoran Civil War came to a close, but the refugees the crisis created are once again in the news.
Since 1990, Salvadorans have been granted temporary protected status in the U.S., but earlier this year, the Trump administration stripped them of their protection, ordering nearly 200,000 people to return to El Salvador.
Many are parents to American children, and they haven't been back to the war-torn country in decades. And El Salvador itself is still recovering from the crisis, as gangs imported from America have made life in the country even more difficult.
Recently, a group of Wisconsinites traveled to El Salvador to the small town of Arcatao as part of the Madison Arcatao Sister City Project. Barbara Mergen Alvarado has been working with the project since the mid-90s and was part of the trip along with State Senator LaTanya Johnson and Jonathan Solari from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin.
They sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and Solari starts by describing their trip to a migration center in the country's capital, San Salvador.
It was an incredibly difficult experience. We are fortunate that we were able to be in a migration center when a arrival of 300 returnees from the United States were beginning their process of reintegrating in their homes. We entered this facility with a giant fence outside with people's family members who were sitting outside waiting for them. And we're given a tour through the facility by a migration officer. And I think that what was most compelling was the humanity with which everyone was treated. We asked them outright, are these people returning criminals? And they said, no, they're our brothers and sisters. And they pursued a dream, and they failed, and we want to make their reentry into our country as seamless and as easy as possible, despite the horrible circumstances that they're facing. I was struck by the healthcare that was provided, the counseling, the resources that were there awaiting them. Now, of course, once they leave that facility, life is difficult. And I don't mean to paint a picture where El Salvador, it's a beautiful country, the people are inspiring. Things are hard there, and it is a truth that people come to this country in order to seek asylum from persecution, from certain death in some instances, and that's something that is a policy that I believe we need to continue to uphold.
There was a young lady there, and she looked to be in her mid-20s. She spoke perfect English. And I couldn't help but wonder how long she had been in the U.S. and why she was returning. And, you know, you kind of wonder all of their stories. Where had they been? Why were they returning or coming back? But the way that they were welcomed back was exceptional, because you have this image of what you think that these facilities are like. And then to actually see how they are helped to transition back into their homes and to know that life was going to be a lot different from them when they return than what it was here in the U.S. because I think the monthly wage there is $300 a month. So there's a lot of poverty there. Just to be able to find a job and to be self-sufficient is going to be a challenge there.
I think part of that image that you're referencing, LaTanya, is something that we're seeing a lot of now in the mm-hmm. last month or two, these horrifying, unacceptable images of children in cages and families being torn apart at our borders. And I think one of the most difficult things about that experience of seeing the migration center in San Salvador was not in that center itself, but upon returning to this country mm-hmm. and seeing the way that we are treating the brothers and sisters and children of the people that we built relationships with.
Yeah, and I think that maybe was the most astounding thing for me, because when I think of immigration officers, what comes to mind are exactly as Jonathan said, what is happening at the border. And also the policies right now, the temporary protected status of Salvadorans that came here way back and have continued to come here. But a lot of Salvadorans came during the Civil War time right after as refugees, and they were given temporary protective status, which Donald Trump has taken away. And now they have, I think it's a year from August, to do something about that. So we're talking over 200,000 people that will be sent back to El Salvador. And what struck me was the difference of what we're seeing here at our border and how we receive people in a horrible way if they're coming from the South, and especially if they're coming from Central America. And they've made this incredible long track through Mexico, which is its own story of how people are treated. There are agreements at the southern border of Mexico with the Mexican government and the U.S. government how to keep people out of even Mexico so they can't even make it to the U.S. border. We've got to keep working on what's going on here in the U.S. because these are our brothers and sisters. And as I think all of us think, we realize that people are coming for a better life, people are coming for opportunities, and yet no one wants to be separated from their family. Mm-hmm. Everyone in Arquetao who had a story to tell would tell about their brother, would tell about their children, would tell about their family members who came here basically because there weren't any options. And a whole other problem is that during the 80s, many young people came to the U.S., went to L.A. especially. And then because they were immigrants, they couldn't find jobs. Part of the large, large gang issue, which is very prominent now in El Salvador, was the deportees that were made to leave Los Angeles years ago and now have these incredible drug gang groups that are raging throughout El Salvador. Thankfully, not in Arquetao, but people are very aware of what's going on in their country.
Now, we've talked about some of the problems that are facing El Salvador, gang-related issues, and unfriendly legislation. Jonathan, you're from Planned Parenthood. Why did Planned Parenthood have a reason to go to El Salvador?
Well, I can say that I was invited partially because of my involvement with the Madison Sister City Project at large. And my day job, as you mentioned, is with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. El Salvador has perhaps the most restrictive laws around reproductive health in the Western Hemisphere. There are no exceptions for abortion in terms of rape or incest. There are women in El Salvador who have miscarried, wanted children, and have sentences that they're serving in prison for decades of their life. It is a war on the poor, in particular. Poor women who don't have access to health care are suffering because of a closed-minded legislature. And there is incredible work being done by community organizations and advocacy groups. One in particular, Cumcavis Trans, is a LGBTQ plus organization that's been around for a decade that has fought for the rights of their brothers and sisters and also been a leader in the fight to make a more just law around abortion access. The reason that they're doing that is because the violence against LGBTQ individuals is so intense in El Salvador that lesbian women are being raped as a form of, for lack of a better term, corrective punishment, because they know that if they're raped and impregnated, they have to carry the child to term. And if not, they'll go to jail. So this is the landscape where people are working. And it is a haunting vision of what could be possible in patches of this country. And regardless, it is a lesson in organizing and fighting for what is right, despite unbelievable odds.
Well, and ultimately, it's an environment that we're saying it's fine to return refugees to. That seems to be what the U.S. government is saying, unfortunately. What do you think we in America, I mean, we're talking to a group of Americans, what do you think we can learn from looking at what's happening, not just to women and reproductive rights, but also to the returnees, the former refugees who are now living in this landscape? What can we learn from your trip, really?
I think the thing that struck me about the conversations that we had, some of the stories that we've been able to tell here today, were gifted to us so that we would spread the word, so that we would treat our neighbors better, because we don't know if the person that is being discriminated against is the child of one of our new friends in El Salvador. And the more we reverberate the truths that we experience, ideally, the more empathy will be contagious in our communities.
And one of our objectives was to look at organizing outside election issues, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for me, and I've been going to El Salvador since 1998, one of the most inspiring things is that the Salvadorans of the grassroots movement, which is the majority of the country, have been able to overcome incredible odds after an incredibly harsh civil war. And they are able to think about organizing, and as LaTanya spoke about, having this hope that things can change. And despite all odds, they are able to do that. So I think that's what they give us to a great extent, that elections are fine and elected officials are fine. And we spoke with one very inspiring elected official who's originally from Arcatao, Maria Chichilco, or Maria Serrano, as she was known during the wartime. But I think the inspiration is that coming together and organizing together as grassroots people, we can change. And we can change structures. And they have done that. They now have, with all of the difficulties, they have a former guerrilla leader who formed a part of a party and is now the president of the country, has many difficulties because of the structure of the country and the structure of governmental organizations. But the people actually elected this person. And so to me, it's an inspiration that we in the U.S. can also keep moving forward despite all of our deceptions with our present administration. And if people down there can do it and they're helping to encourage us to do it, then it gives me great hope that we can do it and we can change structures as they have changed structures. One thing that was very interesting was, as Jonathan said, the draconian laws that they have related to abortion and reproductive issues. On the other hand, El Salvador a year ago was the first country in the world to ban mining, to actually have a law that bans mining. And so we kind of questioned ourselves and said, how can it be that they're the first country in the whole world that bans metallic mining as a law, and how can they have this reproductive policy that is goes back to I don't know how many centuries? We talked with the parents of 10 of their 10 children who are now in the U.S., And in the end, we asked the mother, we said, well, how does that make you feel? And she said, you know, I would rather that my children be far away and alive than dead back here in El Salvador. And I think that just really, you know, blew us away, that what extent people will go to the heartbreak that they go through to really value human life. And another lesson for us to really look at and learn from and work with them.
And I think being there and seeing them organize at the grassroots level, and then seeing some of the things that they were fighting for, women equality, just for women to have an opportunity to make their own money, to create their own savings plans. And, you know, with reproductive rights, it was a reminder that, yeah, the U.S. is further along, but at any time, we can go back to where we were. Because even some of the fights now that we're having are the same struggles that they're having, too. We're fighting here for female equality and to make sure that we can continue to keep our reproductive rights. Talking to people who had their lives threatened because they're standing up for LGBT rights. Talking to a lady that had her life threatened because they want to raise chickens and sell their chickens and create a savings account for themselves. And the government feels like men should be doing that and not the women. You know, it just really drives the reality home that even though we're across countries from each other, that our struggles still mirror each other based on who's in power here. At any minute, you can find yourself taking steps back and having to reorganize and refight for those same rights that you had before.
I think that brings up a good point, and specifically around the intersectionality of the empowerment of women and of reproductive rights and of economic empowerment. We as a country, this administration, has revived a global gag rule, mm-hmm. so that we are no longer providing any type of aid to organizations in any sphere of work if they advocate for abortion access. So by recognizing that these things are related, an organization is then punished by our government. Now, we have on the table here a domestic gag rule that may be coming to our communities, to our neighborhoods, where there will be healthcare providers who will be punished if they mention abortion access. That is a scary lesson, and that points not only to our country's influence abroad, but also the lessons to be learned so that we can protect each other mm-hmm. here.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming in and speaking with me and sharing your stories with me today.
Thank you.
Wisconsin State Senator LaTanya Johnson, Barbara Mergen Alvarado, and Jonathan Solari were all part of a group of Wisconsinites that traveled to El Salvador earlier this year.
Alvarado works with the Madison Arkatau Sister City Project, and Jonathan Solari works with Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. They spoke with Joy Powers.
A quick break now, and then we'll learn about how a local woman is bringing kids into the conversation about hunger and nutrition issues. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You probably know people who live their jobs. Raina Andrews would probably fall into that category.
By day, she directs outreach for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, which describes itself as the leading hunger relief organization in the state.
Andrews' work does not stop there, though. She has taken on the mantle of public health ambassador, through which she says she hopes to solve hunger rather than feed the hungry. Recently, Andrews decided to draw kids into the conversation.
She's the author of a new children's book titled Alex McGreen and the Tale of the Mysterious Cat. Kale. Andrews, along with the book's illustrator Brian Bostofka, met Lake Effect Susan Benz outside a hoop house filled with growing kale. Andrews began by explaining how her collaboration with Bostofka came about.
So Brian and I teamed up through a mutual friend. I originally had a publisher, and that friend kept on saying, you know, I've got a colleague of mine who really, really is digging this concept and would love to work on your children's book. I said, well, you know, I already have someone, but he was really persistent. And I said, well, let me see his work. And it came out to be Brian. And when I saw his work, I was just really drawn to it. And I said, I have to work with him. I've got to meet him. And
virtually,
right. Because today is actually our first time meeting in person. And I feel like we're family, like I've known him forever, because he really got me. He got the concepts, and this book would not be the same without him.
So what is it about Raina, Brian? What do you get about her?
Sure. I can totally understand her passion. So just meeting Raina, you can tell right away that she's very passionate about everything that she does, and was very passionate about the book from the get-go, which is exciting and invigorating and got me excited as well. I think we teamed up really well to bring the characters to life and make them what they are. She's very complimentary, which is always nice to hear when you're creating stuff. So
yeah. Even if she wants a little tweak, Brian, that's just perfect. But
yeah. It would be even perfecter.
You always have to sandwich it.
Yeah. Oh, this is great, Brian. You know, I really like this, but, you know, can you make her hair just a little bit bigger?
Yeah. And she does have big, beautiful hair. So where did Alex McGreen come from? Is she you?
You know, everyone says that Alex McGreen looks like me, but I thought it was very important to have the protagonist be a young African-American girl, one, because of the community that I work with on a daily basis. I think in the food literacy space, and specifically in the food security space, there are so many Alex McGreens that don't get their story told about why eating healthy is important, or having the protagonist be a superhero that's an African-American little girl. And so having that representation really mattered to me. Alex McGreen is because I love the name Alexandra, and McGreen because she's eats a lot of greens. I wish I had something sexier to say about her.
How did the story begin to come to you?
So prior to writing the book, I was doing a lot of food literacy around lead awareness in our community, and really the lead epidemic that was happening predominantly on the north side in our city due to the replacement of the lateral lines in older homes. And so I was going to community health clinics and doing education around why it's important for us to eat superfoods like dark leafy vegetables. And adults got it, but I wanted to really change the habits of our next generation, and I wanted to create a legacy that would live on. And so I thought, what better way through a children's book where I boil it down to the most basic concept that a child could get it. And kale, I go kale crazy. I love kale and everything. And so I looked at kale as a gateway veggie.
Gateway veggie, that's meaning, great. Well, it's delicious and...
And it's
hey,
good
you
for
know?
You. Absolutely. So whenever I give a child a book and I sign it, I said, remember to eat your veggies because they bring out your superpowers. Because the power of kale is that it's able to draw out a lot of the toxins in our body, because lead is found in bottled water. It's a naturally occurring mineral, but there's superfoods like kale and spinach that's able to draw it out. And I mean, Popeye already had spinach, so I went with kale.
Yeah, smart.
So what did you learn, or did you learn things in the process of all this, Brian? Not only, you know, working with a new person, but, you know, what else?
It's my first time ever really doing a kid's book. I did one just for our family, just for fun. So I had a practice round in a way, but this was really the first time putting that together. So techniques and the way that I did things, the process behind it, artistically was new to me.
So meaning what, the way that you did things?
Sure. So the first step would be that I just sketched out a picture in a sketch pad or on a piece of drawing paper, and took a quality photo of it, uploaded it to the computer, and then used Photoshop and online tools to add the color and the depth and backgrounds. And that process was the first time I went through that. So I learned a lot and got better as the process went along.
In developing the story, Raina, did you talk with kids, or do you hang out with kids, or is this just all coming out of you?
So this is really reality meets fiction. So I served as a board chair of a local charter school, and there was lead in our water, and for over a year, our students were unable to drink out of the water fountains. And so that's why it started with Alex McGreen in her fifth grade class, and they find lead and they send them home. And we did something very similar, and the lead issue was never really fixed, right? And so what this book, how it pivots, is that Alex takes on the health and well-being of her classmates. And so that's where it was really born, is out of a real-world situation.
Have you taken that book to that school? And, you know, what has the reaction been, not just among the kids, but the adults?
Absolutely. So I brought it back to the charter school where I was the chairwoman, and the principal absolutely loved it. The students enjoy it, although it's at a sixth grade, seventh grade level, but they can see themselves in the book. They love the illustrations. They enjoy the story. And whenever I do readings, I just can't read a book. I have to recreate it, generate questions, get young people to problem solve and think about, if you were Alex McGreen, what would you have done in this situation?
You've said that you want everyone to have this book. This is early in your book's life, but what do you see happening so far? What are the challenges that you and others who care so passionately about this issue face in making a difference?
I would say that this isn't just a book. This is a movement that we're causing that's being translated and retold through storytelling. And the challenges that we're up against with any movement is having people understand it, not boiling it down to the most simplest, making it so simple that, oh, we could do this, but also understanding the complexity of food insecurity and nutrition and the advertising world that, you know, the pros and cons, the fight, right? And so the challenges that I've come up against is duplicating myself to spread the word. And so I've worked with high school students to teach them how to read to young people. They know how to read, right? But to truly do storytelling and recreating the characters and creating that piece of engagement. And also being able to have this book be accessible to the masses.
I think one thing that Raina might not have touched on was the sense of community that happens in the book.
Right.
It is a lot about eating healthy and educating kids about that, but it's also about joining together for a positive cause, and that's what Alex and her mother do, and thinking about people more than yourself, and I think that's a really important message. And Raina was talking about storytelling and just kids' books in general, and I think this is the perfect tool for her mission and her movement, because kids' books and storytelling, yeah, it's wonderful to be able to tell the story, right? It's great, but what it really does is it opens up an avenue for conversation with kids, and it's a fun way to do that. So you can start conversations that aren't always easy to talk about or to bring up, or that aren't always interesting to kids. It's a way to start that and spark that flame.
I'm totally agreeing. I'm nodding to everything Brian says. I'm like, yes, that's it. Thank you. I think I would really look
really
at...
met sooner.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, Brian has been an extraordinary partner in this, not only as an illustrator, but really as a thought partner, as in, hey, have you considered this? You know, I caught that. It's like, you know, I'm not really connecting the dots here. And so as you swim in the literature for so long, having that fresh perspective was really refreshing and helpful to have some new eyes on it and to be able to be open enough and confident to provide that feedback without me being, this is my writing. I wrote this, so I'm not going to change it. And so we really had that give-get that was perfect.
Did the process take you places that you didn't expect?
Absolutely. This process completely stretched me, because I figured I was going to sit down, I was going to write a book, he was going to illustrate, we were going to get published. We're going to do this in 6 months, right?
And it was?
It was 6 months.
Yeah, we did it in about 6 months.
Oh, yeah. My God, you show up.
And it typically takes about a year or two. Yeah. To get a book like this done. And so, I mean, I don't know how Brian would describe me, but he's like, you're pushing too hard. I've got a family. But for me, it was about the movement and momentum. And I just had the laser focus on this. It's like, we've got to get it done. And Brian being the artist that he is, he's like, it's got to feel right. It's got to be right. Like, I'm not going to put out junk. And I'm so happy that we both stood firm on our commitments to have such an exceptional product.
Is there enough coordination among people who care?
Absolutely not. So, Susan, I did a TEDx 2 years ago on food insecurity as a public health concern. And it really talks about the nonprofits and the social service area not being willing to work together. And we operate from a scarcity model rather than an abundance. And imagine if we all put our puzzle piece down, what we can create in this beautiful picture. And I think our intentions are well, but we get so laser focused and in a vacuum on our own initiatives, we forget to think about duplication and what someone else is doing that could be complementary rather than us exhausting resources on our own projects.
So part of the complexity there would be, I would think, not only, you know, we all have our egos and our personalities and
Absolutely.
Our style, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's the potential of competing for dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, dollars will have organizations participate in Mission Drift, and I think we see it all the time. But as I said before, like, people are, as organizations, we participate in this scarcity model rather than abundance. And the reality is that resources are tight right now. And so if you come together with this collective impact for the greater good of the community and sticking to your mission and finding complementary organizations, those dollars can stretch even further. And what we've seen is that funders are looking to fund organizations and nonprofits that will work together to have their dollars stretch further.
So what do you think, what do you hope that this book accomplishes?
Well, in the next year, I'd really like for this book to not only have a market penetration seriously throughout Wisconsin, but really throughout the country. I thought what was really exciting is just earlier this week, I got a call from a Catholic school principal out of Kansas City, Missouri, who saw the book online. One of her girlfriends bought the book and she wants it in her classroom and she wants me to Skype in to read it to our kids. And so this is what I mean by having a healthy food movement, having kids get rerouted to the source of their food. She says we have aquaponics, we have kale hoop gardens, we have a vertical garden in our school, we have the chef who makes kale chips. I mean, and the young lady looks like our student population. So for me, it's so important that young people see themselves in this book. I mean, whether it's ethnic, whether it's from a character, or whether it's whatever it is, I want people to see themselves. And I really want this to truly be a legacy for the next generation to reconnect them to the source of their food.
At WUWM.com, you'll find more out about Alex McGreen and the tale of the mysterious kale, as well as a link to the TEDx talk author Raina Andrews mentioned in her conversation with Lake Effect Susan Bentz.
We will take another break and then join local guitar hero Greg Koch and his trio as they rock the house, or at least our performance studio. That comes your way when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's Greg Koch is not only a guitar player of extraordinary skill and musicality, he is also something of a master wordsmith as well. He has said his trio of guitar, drums, and Hammond B3 organ provides concertgoers with organ-fueled grooves of doom.
Well, doom was not what came to mind last year during a Lake Effect session with what was then a brand new band, the Koch Marshall Trio. Although organ-fueled, it certainly was, along with some exemplary shredding on the part of Mr. Koch. Here they are with a Koch original tune called Let's Get Sinister. Thank you.
the Cock Marshall Trio in Lake Effects Studio C. Gentlemen, it is so great to hear you. That was Let's Get Sinister.
Indeed.
I'm ready. Are we already sinister?
Indeed we are.
I think so. After that, we certainly are. But let's go around, introduce yourselves, what you play, please.
Greg Cock, electric guitar.
Dylan Cock, son of Greg Cock, drums.
Toby Lee Marshall, Hammond organ.
And that Hammond B3, that's the first time we've had one in here, Toby.
Well, it's my pleasure to be the first.
Oh my gosh, it's so fantastic to hear in here. And, you know, I've got pictures which will go on the website, but for those of us who haven't seen one before, it's got what, two keyboards? Three.
Two manuals, yep. Each keyboard's a manual. It's got lots of controls. It's like flying a plane, really.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's very close.
It kind of sounds like it when you turn it on. We were noticing that it sounded like it was warming up.
Yep.
Yeah. And a part of that is that big amplifier you got sitting
there. That's the Leslie speaker. That's the other half of the equation.
I noticed you were kind of playing the bass part, too.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. So is that why you don't have a bass player? You don't need one with him?
Well, let's just put it this way. The unique grooving skills of Toby's left hand is complemented by his glorious comping and soloing skills by his right hand. So together, they make a superhero.
I was going to say a full package.
Yes.
It is a full, a superhero full package. A B Hammond B3 superhero.
Exactly.
Yes.
Forget about Marvel.
No. Do you have a cape?
It's implied.
Yeah, I see that.
Yes, obviously. Yeah.
It's assumed.
Indeed.
Yes, it really is assumed. So, Greg, tell me about this group. How long have you been in this iteration?
Well, this is a good story, Bonnie. Are you ready?
Yep, I am.
I'll try to make it succinct. So Dylan has been going up and playing with a young guitar player in River Falls, Wisconsin by the name of Dylan Sulfur. So there's two Dylans. So I get confused when I start talking Dylans. And this Dylan Sulfur just graduated from high school, but whilst in high school, a very resourceful young man. Not only can he play great, and he's a prodigy of as far as every sense of that word is concerned, but he's also a go-getter. And he found out that there was this guy living in River Falls who had kind of retired from the music industry, one Toby Lee Marshall, who spent years on the road with Bernard Allison, and as an 18-year-old was playing with Lonnie Brooks and so on and so forth. Make a long story short, Dylan from River Falls contacted my Dylan because he saw us playing together and said, would you be interested in doing some gigs? So my Dylan went up and then found out that the other guy in the gig was one Toby Lee Marshall. So my son would come back home and he'd go, you got to hear this keyboard player. He's really, really great. He played with Bernard Ellison. You got to hear Toby. I'm like, oh, yeah, sounds great. Yeah. You know, I'm busy doing whatever I'm doing. So finally one day Dylan says to me, hey, Toby's coming down. He's picking up a Leslie speaker that he's purchasing from John Kames. So my Dylan keeps on saying to me, we've got to get together and jam with Toby when he comes down. Well, what every grizzled music professional wants to do on a day off is jam with his son's friends. And so it's getting closer and closer to the day. And finally, Dylan's like, you know, Toby's going to be here tomorrow. I was like, well, you know, we've got that keyboard in the basement. And he's like, Daddy's not going to play that piece of crap. He plays B3. That's all he plays. Maybe we can move the furniture in the front room and move the B3. And I go, that'd be great. We could move the furniture and scuff the floor. And then we could say, hey, Mom, that's where we were jamming with Dylan's friends. So I thought, you know what? I know a guy. My buddy Steve Hamilton has a studio. He's got a B3, I know, all set up, ready to go. So on the day of, I just called up this Steve Hamilton just going, hey, Steve, I have no idea if you're even available today or what you're doing, but I got this guy coming to town. Apparently, he's a great B3 player, and he's a friend of Dylan's, and yada, yada, yada. He's like, no problem. Show up at around 2 o'clock. I'll have everything mic'd up, ready to go, and you guys can rehearse, and I'll record it, and, you know, we'll see what happens. So Toby arrives, has no idea what's happening, other than that Dylan maybe have told him that we might jam. So Toby comes in, and I go, hey, you know what? Nice to meet you. We got a jam coming, and you know, if it works out, I'll throw you some dough, and we'll consider it. We'll start a record. And he's like, what? That sounds great. So we go over to Steve Hamilton's. I bring this amp and a guitar, and we plug it in, and the B3, or the C3, I guess, there, right? Yep. It's all set up, ready to go. Drum set's ready to go. So I call a shuffle tune. I go, let's just do like a shuffle in G. And I counted it off, and we recorded it. And that's actually going to be the first tune on the record, the very first notes we ever played together. It was so instantaneous. I went, oh, my God, here we go.
So the first notes, the first take.
Yes.
I'm impressed.
It was glorious. And the dynamic, I mean, it just, you know, because obviously Dylan had played with Toby, so there was already a thing. And Toby being the bass player and the keyboard player in one, they'd already had a thing. And, of course, Dylan and I have a thing. So it was immediate. So
many things.
I knew right then and there that a glorious and for me, this particular format, a lot of my chord stuff that I've come up with over the years is very B3 centric, and you know, kind of a gospel-y.
Show me what you mean.
So if I do something like a you know. I do like a all that kind of stuff is B3-esque, you know. And if I'm writing tunes, you know, like a play, right? Or, it's influenced by gospel
absolutely
stuff, you know. Yeah. And so when Toby plays, it's gospely, bluesy, but it's got that rock sensibility as well, which is important. And it's got just enough jazz to get us in trouble. So if I throw some chord changes at him, he can handle the chord changes, but it doesn't sound like, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying that, but the organ trio thing has been done. You know, usually the guitar player is playing some, you know, Gibson hollow body instrument and flat
and doing
long strings.
A lot of like 7 and 9 chords and
yeah, and doing stuff, doing yeah. The Kenny Burrell thing, which mm-hmm. is glorious, or yep. Wes Montgomery. It's all great stuff. But this is kind of like a, you know, Booker T on the way to Hendrix meets the Meters and Zeppelin going to the chicken campfire.
Yeah, I was going to say a little dirtier.
Yeah, there's definitely filth.
Yes.
There's definitely
which is, of
filth.
Course, why I always invite you back.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Because there just isn't enough filth in public radio.
Exactly.
You know, we just need to do more.
Yeah,
more
absolutely. I'm glad to be able to provide that service.
Me too. Me too. I'll call on you every single time. So what's the next song we're going to hear? This is another Greg original?
It is indeed. Well, why don't we do the Boogaloo now, since we talked about it? And this is kind of a funny thing, because this is one of the first tunes that we played together of mine. We just kind of made up two tunes as we went into the studio, and then I had this Boogaloo tune. Actually, John Seeger wrote lyrics for the song, but we never got to the point where we recorded it in that
environment.
I was going to
say, we need to bring him in, and we'll do the vocal version.
There you
too.
Go, if yeah. we can do that.
Yeah.
And so I had this version, which was just from the original demo that I sent him, which was just an instrumental. And but I always loved a Boogaloo groove. And for those who don't know what a Boogaloo is, it's like a kind of a shotgun thing. But I always like, as you mentioned, The Doors, that song The Changeling by The Doors. I always loved that tune. And I'm powerless over it. Every time it comes on my shuffle on my iPhone, I just got to crank it. And so this was kind of the groove to The Changeling. And then I kind of do this weird head on top of it. And then we did a weird B section. So, and we just kind of jam out.
So this is not the obviously the first time you played it, but this is the original tune.
Correct.
When you all three of you first sat down in the studio.
Well, this is not the very first
okay.
first tune.
Okay.
That was just a shuffle tune. Okay. We could play that one too. We could just make what? It up.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
We could do that.
All right.
We've never played it since.
We haven't.
But it's in G.
It's in G.
Ready?
All right.
Was great. I'm going to call that the K&M Shuffle, Koch Marshall Trio Shuffle.
On the record, we call it Toby Arrives.
Toby Arrives. Well, that's good, too. But here, it's the K&M Shuffle.
There you go. Ooh,
that's it.
The K&M Shuffle.
The K&M Shuffle in G.
Extemporaneous jam in G.
Yeah. That was great.
Thank you.
That was wonderful. I can see why, if it sounded like that, that you wanted
from
to...
From the get-go.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, I've done various different iterations over the years, and they've all been fun, and I always try to mix it up and try to do different things. But I think the balance, you know, my material in this format is it's the right mix of everything.
Oh, it sounds fantastic, and I can tell just watching you guys. I mean, I have the advantage in that I'm actually watching you do this, and I can tell how much fun you guys are having.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's almost the most important thing.
I think so. You got to live in the moment, let the good times roll.
So you're going to take them out on tour?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, things are starting to, people just, they dig this thing. So that's good.
I wonder what it is. You know, for a long time, I mean, in the 60s and the 70s, the B3 was like king.
Yep.
You know, and then it kind of disappeared there for a while. I mean, people were using it, but it wasn't like the golden instrument that it seemed to have been. And maybe it's just coming back. Maybe it's just a sound that people like and they haven't heard for a while.
I think so. I mean, you know, certainly in this kind of a format too, where it's, yeah, it's roots driven, but it's, you know, this is not your grandfather's organ trio.
Well, gentlemen, it has been such a pleasure. Greg, always great to see you.
Thank you
very
much for
having
us.
Dylan, good to see you. It's been ages.
Yes,
and Toby Lee, nice to meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
And it's been great having you guys play in the studio. What are you going to take us out with?
We're going to do that Boogaloo song. Heed,
okay.
It's called Heed the Boogaloo. I think it's important to heed the Boogaloo.
It is.
Cock Marshall Trio playing us out with Heed the Boogaloo. The band is Greg Cock on guitar, his son Dylan Cock on drums, and Toby Lee Marshall on the mighty Hammond B3 organ. Their latest album, Toby Arrives, came out just a few months ago.
You can find all three songs they played for us at WUWM.com, and our in-studio session was engineered by Jason Reavy. That wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. So grateful that you could listen today, and I sure hope you'll be listening again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.